you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At the time we begin the TechNet, as we've done for 36 years, starting in 1982, which meets every Sunday on the Limock Repeater on Long Island at 8 o'clock. And if there's enough enthusiasm, we last until midnight, 4 hours later. As you guys have heard so often, the main purpose of the TechNet is to gather curious radio amateurs who want to know more about wireless equipment, how radio really works, the 27 different kinds of ham radio, 2-meter FM repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 27 kinds. There's a whole lot of other kinds. Let me drop. The TechNet is loosely divided into three sections. One section is the beginning, where people sign in with a question or comment. They give us their call letters, their name, because they do have a question or comment. We take those in order. That's followed by Roy, AC2GS, who runs the Science Talk section. And that's followed by Paul, WS2N, who runs the Space Report. Tonight we'll have a very good space report because of the Parker Polar Solar Satellite was launched this morning. And that has become or will become the highest velocity spacecraft mankind has ever launched. So you'll be hearing details about that. Let me drop. During the week, I discovered, I was brought to my attention by W2RFU, Tom, that there has been for some time another TechNet that's being run Sunday evening, starting at 8 o'clock, in Boca Raton, Florida. So they run their TechNet at the exact same time as ours. And with the conversations I had with Tom, there's a chance that their TechNet will log into the IRLP or the Echo Link of this repeater, and therefore there is the possibility of linking, or at least some questions and comments coming from Boca Raton, that is possible. You guys have also heard in the past, we get questions and comments from Canada, for instance, from the Toronto area. And so by similar means, by way of Echo Link or IRLP, so we can get check-ins from not only the tri-state area in New York City, which is directly covered by RF with this particular repeater, but by Internet, Echo Link, IRLP. In theory, we can get questions from a whole lot of different areas. So I'm going to stand by just in case the TechNet from Boca Raton has anyone that wants to check in tonight. Please give me your call letters at this time from Boca Raton if you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick on Long Island. We're listening.
H-Y-Y.
So I was asking for check-ins from Boca Raton, and maybe they're not going to join us this week, and maybe they'll be doing that next week. So at this time, we'll be taking check-ins for people locally who do have a question or comment. We've already got Joe, W2RYY. Who else would like to check in tonight? Give me a call, that is a name, right now.
This is N2AAM. The name is Dave. Yes.
Okay, Dave, that sounded like November 2, Alpha, Alpha, Mike. Do I have that correct, Dave?
Yes, Dick, that's correct. It's November 2, Alpha, Alpha, Mike. The name is Dave, and I'm located in Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey.
Okay, we got you, Dave. So we got Joe and Dave so far. Anyone else to check in who does have a question or a comment for the TechNet tonight? Please give me your call letters and name right now. One last call. Anyone with any check-in for questions or a comment for the TechNet? K2RIW listening.
Hey, Joe, guys. To let you know that nobody's connected to IRLP. There's a whole bunch of people connected to Echolink, but I don't see any connections from Florida.
Very fine, Echo. I mean, Eric, thank you for that. You did tell us last week that the Fox Network, Channel 5, has last week moved over to the World Trade Center. My question to you is, does that include 5-1, 5-2, and 5-4, all three of them have moved over. Another question I have, is there a 5-3, which I've never seen? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, Fox's RF is coming from World Trade Center. As of last week, I think they turned it on at 11 a.m. I forget which day. But just remember one thing, that the RF carrier can have 100 sub-channels. So, you know, all the five sub-channels, the 5-1, the 5-2, they're all emanating from the same stream. The 5-3 was on the Channel 9 transmitter, but I believe they've dropped that. So, actually, I can take a look and see if you're really interested. K2RIW, K2J.
Hi, thank you, Eric. And maybe you don't have to check. I'm about to go over to Joe, who keeps track of all those things. He's a television DXer for digital television. So is there a 5-3, and have you seen a new change in signal strength because of the move, Joe? W2RYY. Joe to take it. K2RIW and TechNet. You got it, Joe.
Well, that's not my question, but yes, I did, as a matter of fact, take a look at that pilot carrier signal level, and it looks very similar to what it looks a little higher than what it was before, but they're not as strong as RF-33. Which comes in about minus 45 to 48, depending on exact conditions per day. They're about like in the mid-50s, give or take. They were a little less than that off of Empire. But what I did notice is the movement, that funny movement pattern that you may have noticed on 5-4, Eric, where the during movement you'll see nothing like jump. That has gone away. So apparently that was in their transmitting equipment at the old location, because I don't see it now on their transmitter from the new location.
Seeing some more signal strength from them now, is that correct?
Yes, they have more dorky biscuits in the air than they had before, and more is good.
I just want to point out to you guys that, like that issue that you were seeing before, was you were either having a hard time trying to take the signal apart. But depending upon how much data they dedicate to a particular channel, will have an effect on it. But remember, it's all the same stream. It's all coming out of the same hose, so to speak. Depending upon the signal strength and its ability to decode it or turn it into INQ so that it can be taken apart, there's a certain threshold that you have to surpass for everything to work well. And because you were seeing that, it was kind of just on the edge, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Jeff.
Okay, but you noticed the same thing I noticed, that the picture was like jumping around, that the picture had trouble catching up with movement of the characters, but scenery behind it that was not moving was coming in perfectly clear. That effect has gone away, so whatever they did, they fixed it. I'm sure their audience appreciates everything they're doing.
Now you've got my curiosity going. Now I'm going to take the stream apart and see what their bit rates are.
I think you told us that last week, Eric, you did a look at what was going on when Eric was when Joe was saying he was getting lots of this jumping around on 5-4 in particular. And I think you said you saw some extra errors, phase error, I called it, but I know that's not exactly what it was, on the transmitter itself. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW. And maybe that has gone away with the new equipment at the new site.
Well, to be quite honest, I don't remember exactly what it was I was looking at, but I think it was probably the equalizer. But, I'm going to take a look and see how much data they're, you know, how much bit rate they're dedicating to each particular sub-channel. I do remember that it was particularly low, so what that means is when you've got a signal that's just not quite right there, because their packets are less often because they're smaller, they may actually get lost in the error correction, so to speak, because you don't have as much FEC if you're running at a higher bit rate, so... Anyway, we'll see. K2RIW, K2J.
If they dedicate less bits to a particular subchannel, 5-1, 2, or 4, And depending on what the program material is, fast-moving or not, they might have trouble keeping up. I guess I'm a little bit amazed that the system is not dynamically setting the number of bits per sub-channel depending on what's going on. Is that a fixed number that's set during the day and doesn't change regardless of program material? Over to you, Eric.
Now, most people are doing what's called statistical multiplexing, meaning that it actually, you'll know that the stuff is a certain number of frames behind what's actually being transmitted because it takes a little time to process stuff. And what it does is it'll look across the different sub-channels and say, what kind of action is going on here? Do I have high motion? If I have high motion, I got to dedicate some more bits to this. And if I've got a static picture, I can have less bits being transmitted. So the amount of data that's being transmitted per sub-channel is actually changing, and it's based upon what the content of not only that channel is doing, but what the other sub-channels are doing at the same time. So if you were to look at it, like we have a presentation that looks like a pie chart, you can actually see the segments of the pie chart growing and shrinking and moving and changing. And that's all according to content that the system is processing and determining that I've got some spatial motion here, so I need some extra bits for that. Or I've got some high-frequency stuff that I have to deal with. I might need extra bits for that. I've got something that's a cartoon, which basically has four levels of color or four levels of information. And I can use less bits for that, and it actually looks better. And the one thing that you're going to pay for is motion. If you're doing a lower bit rate and you have a lot of motion, there'll be pixelation going on, there'll be blocking going on, especially if it doesn't have any null packets or packets which are just kind of hanging out doing nothing that can use to increase the bit rate. It'll hit a wall at some point because you also set a priority of which sub-channel is more important, which sub-channel is going to get more bits. So there's a lot of stuff like that going on, but no, it's not a constant bit rate for most people. If you've got a cheap encoder and you're not doing statistical multiplexing, then the bit rates are absolutely fixed. And when you have something that really requires more data or more data speed, so to speak, you'll see the artifacts that occur when that happens, when you hit the wall and you can't get more bits when you need them.
Good information, Eric, and I thank you. In the old days of NTSC television, the picture was painted on the screen in a thoroughly sequential manner. You knew exactly what part of the picture was being updated when. In the case of the new digital 8VSB system, I am guessing that the data is sent in the equivalent of packets. I know it's not really a packet, but equivalent of a packet. And I presume the packet also tells you what portion of the screen is being updated at this time. And it's not at all sequential. If some motion took place in the lower right-hand corner, then the next packet being sent will be dedicated to the lower right-hand corner, and that portion of the screen gets updated, is my guess. Is that even close, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
WK2J. I wish I could say that's a great analogy, but because we're doing a couple of things. We're taking an 8x8 block of pixels. Okay. Oh, by the way, the packets that we actually send are 188 bytes bit. 8 bytes wide, sorry. And all the packets are exactly that width. But because we are transmitting three things, basically three different things. We're doing something called discrete cotine transforms on an 8x8 block and creating a set of coefficients that we're transmitting. We're also doing something called run length encoding. And run length encoding is something where that when you have a picture and you think about a line, and we put a square in the center of the screen, and you've got black, and if you look at one line going through the middle of the screen, you've got black for maybe a third of the way across, and then it's white for another third of the way across, and then it's black a third of the way across. We can actually transmit that line with 3 bytes. We can say that we've got X number of pixels that this particular level, in the case of black, is going to be zero. Actually, the number is something like 70-something. Let me let it drop. Sending us a little bit of information saying, I've got X number of pixels of this value, which is white, which could be 255. And then we've got another little bit of data that says I'm sending X number of pixels at this particular level. So we've got that going on. And when it comes to reconstruction, because we're doing something called MPEG, and it's a bit more complicated than that, where the data is inside that packet and where it actually fits into a screen, right? First of all, we're doing another kind of translation. We actually have a chunk of memory that we call display memory, right? And as these packets come along, and these packets have an identifier saying that I'm a video packet, and the header on it will say which group of 8x8 blocks am I looking at, okay? And it may not be sequential in the way it's transmitted, but the way it's reconstructed into this buffer memory, which your TV set is now getting sent its data. Let me let it drop again. Buffer is arranged so that, let's use Cartesian coordinates and say the upper left-hand corner is 0, 0, and the right-hand corner, if you happen to be running a set that's doing 1080i, it'll be 0, 1920, and then in the bottom right corner it'll be 1080 vertical and 1920 pixels, and when we go to the left side it'll be 1080, comma, 0, so you get the idea in terms of how that's constructed, and that is regularly scanned. That's how you get the image on your set, if you're thinking like a CRT, if you're thinking an LCD or something like that. Each pixel on the screen is actually a memory location that you're filling up. K2IW, K2J.
So depending on the motion that's taking place in the actual source material, the packets that are updating the display matrix can literally hop all over the screen. Upper left-hand corner, then the middle, lower left-hand corner, then the right middle if it wants to. So where the action is taking place, that portion of the display screen, display matrix, is being updated, and it's not necessarily sequential. However, each update has a display length you told me about. So it looks to me like you start at a particular line and then proceed to some number of pixels on that line and then maybe the next line, using up the data of that particular packet that's going into the display matrix. Is that approximately what takes place, Eric? K2IW?
Sort of, but not really. Right, let me put it to you in this form. Each bit of transmitted data is a matrix, okay? The matrix is 8x8, so you've got 8 bits of data in one direction and 8 bits of data in the other direction. They're not each pixel, rather, sorry, I shouldn't say data, because each pixel is 8 bits deep or 10 bits deep. But there's 8 pixels going from left to right, and 8 pixels going from top to down, top to bottom. And, of course, we turn that into coefficients to make the actual data that we're sending smaller. That's part of the compression scheme. But you're actually sending these blocks that are 8x8, so it's not like you have a bit of data and you're scanning to the right. It's a block as opposed to a single line. So that block is going to have actually 8 pieces of 8 lines.
Yes, I do. Now, in the example you gave before, where the first third of the screen is all black, the next third of the screen is all white, and the next third of the screen is all black, that seems to be exceeding the dimensions of an 8x8 pixel block. So I'm a little bit confused by that one, Eric. Go ahead.
Okay, you have a buffer memory that's the exact size of the screen that's making a display. Now, there's two separate ways of looking at this memory, okay? You've got this entire screen's worth of memory, and you can write into this buffer, okay? You can start to fill up the numbers that belong in all the holes. That's one way. And then this piece of memory that's the shape of the screen, by another set of counters, is reading the pixel numbers from zero and following the line to the right, just like the way you describe it. So we've got two separate things going on. We've got a current piece of memory. We're now reading this memory at a regular rate, at a field rate, if it's an I thing, or at a frame rate, if it's a P thing. So 1080i is interlaced, and 1080p, which you don't actually transmit over the air, but 720p, which you can, is what we call progressive, which means we do line 1, line 2, line 3, line 4, line 5. And that's happening on a regular basis, okay, which actually has nothing to do with what's coming in. You've written into this memory through another path, but the screen that your eyeballs are seeing is constantly reading from left to right and top to bottom. Does that start to make some sense to you now?
A little more, but now I've got another question. If I have a packet of data that in one sense can represent 8 wide by 8 high pixels, and I can hop around on the screen as to which portion has the action, and therefore the display matrix needs updating for that portion of the display matrix. If I'm updating the display matrix in that manner, it doesn't sound to me like there's any difference between progressive and interlace. If I was really transmitting interlace, I would be transmitting the lines in a sequential manner, very similar to the old NTSC technique. Over to you, Eric, K2RAW.
Okay. On one hand, yes, kind of. But on the other hand, no, okay, because what happens is that we're making, when we're actually making the DCTs, the discrete cosine transform to the block, in the case of the 8x8 block of pixel, in the case of interlaced, the way we digitize it is we'll do line 1, 8 pixels of line 1, and 8 pixels of line 3, and 8 pixels of line 5, and so on, until we finally get to the eighth line, and we do the same thing again in the next field timing of 8 pixels of line 2 across, 8 pixels of line 4 across, and so on and so forth. When they arrive into the buffer memory, of course, this is all happening at a faster rate than the field rate, or an equivalent rate, because we're actually sending multiple stuff, and there's a difference between bit rates and compression and bit rates in terms of being able to display on the screen. That's why we have this buffer. It's an in-between. The actual movement of the data to the screen is triggered by a flag that says, I'm ready, this is the next picture, now display it. K2RAW, K2J.
It seems to me like we have the ability to fill up the required spaces of the display matrix at the rate at which you're sending these 8x8 block, 8 pixels wide, 8 pixels high, so to speak, a packet block. That's going into the display matrix. I am guessing that the display matrix gets shifted to the screen that I see at 60 frames per second, 30 frames per second, 120 frames per second. So the display rate from the display matrix into the screen that I see can be very disconnected from the rate at which I'm updating the data that's in the display matrix. Is that somewhat true? K2RAW, go ahead, Eric.
Absolutely true. But don't forget that the actual maximum rate that you can transmit over the air is 19.39 megabits per second, right? Now, if you were to take the raw data of 1080i, right, that means if I take the digital stream out of the camera meaning the camera is going to be sending me from left to right, and it's going to be sending me numbers for every single pixel, okay? And when I add that all up, that stream rate is 1.1652 gigabits per second. So in order to transmit it into a 19.39 megabit stream, we got to somehow or other slow it down, but yet still maintain the information. That's what the compression is about. So an 8x8 matrix of pixels can be sent and represented by a single number. And that single number is the coefficient that's created when doing an FFT and an inverse cosine transform on that 8x8 group of pixels. K2RW, K3J.
But to backtrack a little bit, I can see how you're updating the display matrix at a rate that's proportional to how fast the picture is moving, what portions of the picture need updating. However, the display matrix is now dumped into the display matrix. The storage is dumped into the screen that I see at, let's say, 60 frames per second or 120 frames per second. But the method by which it's dumped truly is sequential or interlaced, progressive or interlaced. So the screen that I see is being updated in a progressive or interlaced manner. But the display matrix that's storing the data temporarily, that data can be jumping all over the place as to which portion of the screen is updated depending on where the action is taking place. Is that somewhat true, K2RIW?
Again, it gets a little more complicated. On one hand, yes, on the other hand, no. And the reason why is because the transmitter itself is sending streams of data, right? Every little bit of data that's sent over the air is exactly 188 bytes wide. So at the header of each one of those packets is a value which says, I'm a video packet. And then there's another piece there that says, I'm piece number so-and-so when you put this puzzle together. So it goes in this particular location. And then the next packet might be a different sub-channel, or it might be the time of day, or it might be the guide information that you see on the screen. Those are all 188 byte-wide packets, and they occur at different points in time in terms of the serial stream that's being sent. So, if you think of when you take a bunch of bits and you put them into a chip register, let me go to that. You clock the shift register at the same rate at which the data is coming, and you say to the shift register, okay, I've loaded the shift register with 8 bits or something. Okay, now is the end of the clock time, grab that set of numbers, take that set of numbers out, and send it to the next thing which says, oh, this is a video thing, and it goes here. And then the next packet that comes along, it might pull out 8 bits and say, oh, this is a guide thing. Put that here. Are you beginning to follow?
Yes, I am. But if I'm only looking now at the picture update packets, it seems to me like in the display matrix, I can jump all over the place depending on where the action is taking place, where the changes are occurring. So on only those packets that are picture-oriented, I can be updating the display matrix in a quasi-random manner. But the display matrix itself is displayed into the real display that I see in a truly sequential manner of linear, of a progressive or interlaced, depending on what format that screen is being updated. Is that true, K2RIW?
Absolutely correct. If you draw a line and say, this part just updates the screen, and it's doing it the way you would normally do it in the analog TV, where you start at the upper right, throw a line to the right, shut the light off, bring it back to the left, and then start doing the next line. If it's progressive, it'll be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If it's interlaced, it'll be 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, and then on the next field, 2, 4, 6, 8, so on and so forth. So that dividing line now is where we fill this buffer up. Now, if we look at the MPEG compression itself,
okay, the anti-confession doesn't always send a full picture. We have something called an iframe or an information frame, which actually is a representation of pixel by pixel of everything that's happening, okay? Then we have something called a B-frame or a bidirectional frame, which looks at a previous field and says, ah, this pixel is starting here, and it's got a future field, and it says, oh, this pixel has to move over here. And it just sends the information to say, okay, move this pixel, change that one, move that one. So when you look at the, and there's also something called a P-frame, which is a predictive frame, which uses past and forward information to say, okay, I've got major changes here, and here I'm only going to send those bits of information. So when you look at an iframe as a still frame, you'll find out the information for the whole picture is there. If you look at a B-frame, it actually looks like just the edge information of the picture. And if you look at a P-frame, sort of a blend between, edge lines and flat surfaces. I'm trying to give you a visual description. Whereas at a...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
On the Morstan machine, you timed out for about 45 seconds, Eric, but you continue to come out of the Eastern machine. And I didn't hear you on the input on this particular occasion on either machine. That's becoming more clear to me now. When the system is limited in the amount of data that's been dedicated to that subchannel, and if the data only changed by a small amount, in other words, a level 241 pixel became a level 242 pixel, a very minor change, is the system smart enough to say, because I'm limited in the amount of data I can send right now, I'm not going to bother updating that one. The change is too small. Is the system adaptive in that manner is question number one. And question number two, if a whole block of 8x8 pixels happens to be something that's happening in translation, the camera is being panned. And so without changing that, all of those pixels, all I've got to do is shift them to the right by two pixels and everything's hunky-dory. Can the system do that kind of a block shift? Two questions there, Eric. Over to you, KE2AJ, K2IW.
Again, so you said you lost 45 seconds of where I was, and I'm blabbing too much. Again, MPEG has something called an iframe, which has the entire information of the entire frame or field of picture. You've got these bidirectional frames that have some before and after. You have these predictive frames that predict what's coming next. So, in your example of just a group of pixels, one block being changed in position on the screen, it will actually send two bits of data. It will send what the old block should change to, and it will then send what the new block should change to. And that would be it.
Well, my question is, during that shift of that block, because the camera is being panned, do all of the pixels of that block have to be updated? Or is there a way of more briefly saying, take block number 45 and shift it two pixels to the right, but leave all of the pixel values the identical value they were before? Can it do that to make the transmission more compact? Over to you, Eric.
Inside the MPEG engine, there's a motion estimator. Okay, and there's actually a number of things that go on where it will actually filter spatially the motion and decide how far should I, how often should I send an update, and should I blur those pixels in between, and at what level should I blur those pixels in between, especially when there's fast motion. Don't forget, it takes the encoder a little while to figure all this out, because you're X number of frames behind when it finally comes out of the encoder as opposed to the input to the encoding device.
Okay, you're describing a kind of latency. Is the period of latency fixed, or is the period of latency variable depending on what's taking place? Over to you, Eric.
Right, in MPEG encoders, they tend to be somewhat fixed, where there's another type of compression that we use for real time, where the propagation delay to it, I think, is like 80 or 90 milliseconds. Isn't that 80? No, it's, 20 or 30 milliseconds. And that type of compression actually uses much more data. It's a much faster stream to contain all the information, and there's no motion estimation going on, so it's almost like having a lossless compression. Whereas the MPEG that we use, and the newer ones for the in the cable boxes, which is MPEG-4, and for 4K, which is called HEVC, the motion estimators work harder, and the propagation delay through the encoder is a bit longer.
When, at some later date, 6 months, a year, 2 years from now, when the United States updates from 8VSB method of transmission to COFDM, ATS-3, when we go to the new system, RF-wise, a lot of change is going to take place, the way we encode and decode RF-wise. But the way the display matrix is updated in blocks and the compression techniques that are being used, will they be essentially fixed with the new system? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, the hardware aspect of it will be the similar thing in terms of display, whereas you're actually going to be writing into a buffer somewhere that's going to make it go to the screen. But one thing about ATSC3 is that it's very software-based, meaning built into it right now, it will have an MPEG-2 decoder, it will have an MPEG-4 decoder, it will have an HDEC decoder if it happens to be 4K. And should development go on, they could actually create, you know, as the compression codecs get more efficient, they could actually load that software-wise and, you know, bring you the improvements in terms of being able to put more channels in it or higher resolution picture, so on and so forth.
What's your best guess as to when the switchover to COFDM, ATS-3, might likely take place? Will it be a slow trade-over? In other words, certain channels will be used simultaneously in both COFDM as well as 8VSB, and therefore they'll slowly fade out the phase out the 8VSBs and continue the COFDMs. How soon can I buy a COFDM television receiver? Over you, Eric, K2RIW.
All right, the latest update that I'm seeing says probably just before the CES show. So it looks like in certain areas where there is COFDM transmission, there will be receivers available probably by the end of this year or sometime in the first quarter of next year.
Will I have COFDM in the New York City metropolitan area by the spring of 2019? Therefore, I can walk into Home Depot and buy a COFDM compatible television set spring of 2019 if I'm living in the New York City area. Is that a possibility?
Now, changes are made in different areas, in different markets. Okay, our change, it comes in July of 2019, where Channel 13 moves to Channel 12, Channel 21 moves to 32, a couple of other people move to different places. At that point, if someone chooses to, they could actually start transmitting ATSC3. They could transmit ATSC3 now in New York City, but that would be kind of ridiculous because nobody would see it. And you're going to need some channel sharing agreements because you want to maintain, when you do go ATSC3, you got an awful lot of 8VSB receivers out there. They're going to keep receiving 8VSBs. You're going to keep transmitting it. So what you might do is say NBC, they currently, from one transmitter, transmit WNJU and WNBC, right? They sell the frequency, so if they were to say they want to go to ATSC3, they could still transmit WNJU and WNBC on the same transmitter, but they would both be COFDM, which would mean they would have to join forces with, say, ABC, and ABC is keeping their 8VSB transmitter going, so they would have to add their content to, say, ABC's transmitter, and ABC might make an agreement where they'll do one ATSC3 type channel on NBC's transmitter. So there's got to be some channel sharing going on, because the FCC is not issuing new licenses for new frequencies, so to speak. You know, you're not going to have two channels, one being ATSC3 and one being...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Because New York City is going to have ATSC3 capability approximately July of 2019 on some of these channel sharing agreements taking place at this time. Eric, go ahead.
Now, for New York City, there's an organization called the MTVA, the Metropolitan TV Association. And the discussions have been ongoing. They're kind of hush-hush about it. And I guess time will tell who's going to share with who, who's going to go ATSC3, who's not, so on and so forth.
So some small amount of ATSC3 in the metropolitan New York City area is likely to be available in July of 2019. Will it be at least another year or two before the complete ATSC3 changeover takes place? Eric, go ahead.
WHYY. I have a question related directly to what you talk about, not my sign-in question.
Go ahead, Eric, and then we'll go over to Joe. Go ahead, Eric.
At this point in time, there is no cutoff date for VSB. The general consensus idea is at least 10 years before it goes away, because that's going to make a lot of TV sets completely inoperable. But I wouldn't hold my breath. It might be 20 years before it goes away completely.
Wow. 10 or more years of continuing 8VSB. I'm amazed that the changeover takes so slowly, because the affluent people in the New York metro area, oh yeah, there's the problem. Only some of us are affluent and can go out and buy another set. An awful lot of people are using rabbit ears and a converter into their old set, and they're watching over the air because they don't want to pay for cable or satellite. And so they've got to continue to get whatever the old system was. WHYY, KQRIW. You'll be able to ask both kinds of questions, Eric. So, Joe. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, one has nothing to do with another.
You already made that clear, and I gave you permission to do both. Go right ahead, Eric. Joe.
Last week, I heard a clip on the news, and in the morning news, I have to catch it before I had to get out to the door, get going, that by 2021... the FCC is making some sort of push to start selling frequencies in what they call T-band. That's basically all communication stuff above 470 megahertz. Now, in this part of the country, not too many TV channels are located there because it's all public service stuff, NYPD, FDNY, and so forth, as well as all the fire departments out here in Long Island using their own localized repeaters in that part of the band. Many of them way up there. Have you heard any truth to that? And do you think they would actually start taking any of the amateur frequency below 450 to be able to put these people elsewhere? Because I can't see them all going to the LTE band, 700 megahertz, and going totally digital. I don't think that would happen. It would cost billions of dollars to do so.
Want me to answer that? You're the only person I know that knows how to.
There's a bunch of politicians that put that idea forth that actually have no idea what's out there. Okay, New York and Los Angeles are very loudly complaining at this point because, notice we don't have a Channel 14, we don't have a Channel 15 or a 16, we do have a 17. We don't have an 18 and a 19. Actually, somebody put up a 19, turned that on, and all hell broke loose. And that's because the FCC's the the broadcast department did not bother to check with the private radio department, because we're one of the largest areas that utilizes 470 to 512. Now, there's another camp out there that says, what are you guys complaining about? We've got those public service frequencies in the 800s that have put aside for public service. And they say, well, you know, Dallas and all these other places around the country are using it, and it works just fine. And not a talking radio system. But people realize that the interoperability, depending upon whose system you bought, isn't very interoperable. That was one of the problems that happened during the when the World Trade Center went down. Let me drop. So there's a lot of very loud voices against this. The politicians aren't really aware. They're not engineers. They have no concept, especially coming from Mr. Schumer, who's in an area where we've gone through changing radios and making, you know, the police department and the fire department crazy because they couldn't even agree on how to share. Well, how that's going to work out, we're just going to have to wait and see. But, you know, as far as the FCC is concerned, you know, we've gone to 2.5 kc worth of deviation just to squeeze more people in. So getting rid of that here in New York or in Los Angeles or in Washington, it's going to be a real problem. And it's going to cost somebody a heck of a lot of money.
Yeah, the name is called Taxpayer.
If I was on 470 right now, and for some reason if somebody is making a naive pronouncement and has the power to do it, then I must shift over to 800 meg trunking system. And if I'm smart enough to know the way RF behaves, that my 800 trunking system might have a lot of incompatibility with my current 470. In other words, the range and coverage and reliability that I'm getting at 470 could be considerably degraded for a bunch of reasons when I go to 800. If I'm smart enough and to know what happened in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina and what happened during the 9/11 incident, I might say, I don't want to go. If I'm smart enough and I make that pronouncement, what happens next, Eric? K2EJ, K2IW.
All right, well, one of the big things that the camp that says 800 is a place you belong says, well, you're in a city and you have all these buildings, and this tinier wavelength penetrates the building better than the UHF stuff does. And so that's what the politicians are hearing.
Yeah, those are great sounding words on paper. And you can write that and make it sound logical. But you really do a test because of the difference in formatting of an 800 meg trunking system and the real difference in the way multipath takes place. And because of the real powers involved and sensitivities involved and so on, and the bandwidth and the thresholds and sensitivities and intermodulation, distortion, and everything else, put it all together. If I did a thorough enough study, I might discover that in New York City, for my fire department, an 800 meg system by the new formatting will not contain anywhere near the reliability and adaptability that I have right now at 400, and I might say, I don't want to make that change. You're ordering me to do something that's going to degrade my current system, and my current system is just barely tolerable in its reliability right now. Over to you, Eric, K2IW.
K2IW, K6DPC. Dick, if you have a chance,
you give me a call? One of the arguments that's being given is, now, of course, we're not doing analog anymore. So, you know, it's either DMR, P25, NXDN, and they actually do work a little better than analog in some of those situations. So, you know, there's multiple arguments on both sides, and how it's going to play out, we have yet to see.
Can I break in a minute?
What percentage of 470 currently being used is going to be abandoned for 800? Is the FCC going to make that kind of a pronouncement, Eric? Go ahead.
Get in for 1 second.
Yeah. At this point, we don't know because this is a politically driven thing. And by the way, the concept of trunking.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Hal, the answer to your question is no. Eric, please repeat your last transmission.
Why not? Are you afraid of KNB?
All right. What I said was is that there's another camp that is saying 800 is good with digital, with GMR, or with P25. The point that I was making is, like with trucking, interoperability. The interoperability, say the fire department has NXDN, the police department has GMR because that's what their budgets allowed them to buy. The only way that they're going to talk to each other is by switching both systems over to analog. And it would be direct, say, between walkie-talkies or walkie-talkies, or many of the repeaters will switch into analog mode in a national emergency. So, I mean, there's pluses and minuses from each side's argument.
This recent mandate where all of the commercial services on the 470 meg band, I'm guessing, and maybe 800, must go over to a narrow band system. What percentage of them have obeyed that mandate already? How successful is that? Are those people happy? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
I remember when it was that the FCC had mandated that you move from 5 kilohertz deviations to 1.5 kilohertz deviation. You know, I think the channel spacing went from, it's now down to 6.25 kilohertz. That's already happened. And all the digital stuff actually maintains the same bandwidth. It fits in the channel spacing. You get, double the use of the old channel, so to speak, which you actually fit two channels into that space now. So, one thing that they don't realize is 800 is pretty damn crowded, and to start moving more stuff in there is going to be problematic.
Yeah, I think you're discussing intermodulation distortion. So, from what you're hearing, all the people have moved over to the 2.5 KC narrowband deviation on the new equipment. Are all those people happy? Nobody's doing any complaining? Everything sounds good to them? And no intermodulation distortion with the close spacing of the channels becoming more and more crowded? Over to you, Eric.
More and more in the commercial world, they've gone to digital formats. If you listen across the band, you'll find that there's very small amounts of analog left. IM products and QPSK is not such a big deal. The FEC and the way the packets are constructed actually make it a little less damaged by neighboring transmitters, so to speak. That's sort of like the way of the world. But in these particular markets, like New York and Los Angeles, a lot of that stuff is pretty full up.
One of the big failures that occurred during 9/11 was that the repeater went down. The normal communication of a fireman through that repeater failed. He wanted to go over to a direct handy-talkie to handy-talkie because the guy's in the basement and he's hollering Mayday on... I'm entrapped and I can't get out, and I think that mode was not available to him. Does the new system have that mode as an emergency mode when required? Over to you, Eric.
One of the nice things about the digital formats, including the DMR that we use, is that they're two different things. There's a mode called talk around, which essentially transmits and receives on the same frequency like you would an analog, and they also... All the radios will work analog if you program to do that. So, That's one of the ways that they can get around the problem, but that doesn't solve the problem of, say, the fire department having P25 and the police department having DMR. In that case, they both have to go to analog to talk to each other, and they have to be on the same frequency.
If I'm only using 2.5 kC of deviation, can I properly transmit all the digital signals I want to in, say, DMR with only 2.5 kC of absolute deviation? Erica, go ahead.
Your normal 5 kC deviation has a bandwidth of 15 kHz, so that was your channel spacing. The bandwidth of the 2.5 kC deviation is 6.25. All the digital stuff is 6.25, so, you know, you're already in compliance with the bandwidth requirements.
Okay, that's 6.5 kC total, plus or minus 2.5 kC. With digital and the kinds of speech compression and digitization and everything else, by your and my standards, is that good sounding audio, or is it just barely acceptable audio like we've got on some cell phone systems? Over to you, Eric.
Depending upon the system, it's different. I, for one, don't get on DMR very often because of the compression, the codec that they use for compression. It's very hard for me to understand people. They're basically doing two different things. They're doing a little form of psychoacoustical compression, which you don't need much of in terms of voice, but they break up the audio spectrum and don't transmit a lot of stuff. So I don't know if you've ever heard of DMR radio. It takes a little while to get used to for most people. P25 is a bit better because the bit rate that they're doing is a bit higher. The Acer Fusion in the wide mode sounds wonderful because they're actually using 90. They're using the whole bandwidth to send data. Whereas, say, DMR, you're chopping up your channel in half with the TDMA. The actual bit rate that winds up going into the codec is something like a little less than 3 kilohertz. So, 3 kilobits, sorry.
Not kilohertz.
Whereas the wide fusion is... It has the ability to do a better job of reconstruction.
Okay, I'm getting the impression. Joe, go right ahead with your real question now, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW, and the TechNet.
Because you've been waiting for a real question. Okay, I had a chance to test my monopole antenna on 6 meters compared to the disc cone. And in the SSB portion of the band, it actually seems to work better because the band was open to Florida, Georgia, and so forth this evening, about an hour and a half ago. It was 2 hours ago, give or take. And several people heard me better off the disco, even though it's not tuned to that part of the band, like 50.135. It transfers better down there than the disco. The disco, I took a look at that with the antenna bridge. This is going to be where my question comes in. The disc cone I'm using is called an AH7000 made by ICOM. Unlike a traditional disc cone, this one has an additional top element. Looks like a little loading coil with a whip on it to give it better performance on low band. And that actually seems to resonate the best at about 49 megahertz, even, give or take. It goes at about minus 30. It goes up better when I get to like 50.1, so the antenna was certainly usable up there because I have used it in the past. But the funny thing was, the disc cone didn't work as well as the monopole did. The monopole was cut for 52.600. But that's not really my question, because it's just, I guess, just that's the way it works. The disc cone seems to have... caught myself the TOT. The disc cone seems to have very funny responses. If I look at the thing using a tracking generator, the antenna bridge, I can sweep it in like at 140 megahertz, like either 1 meg or 10 meg per division. I can see the return loss go down to like minus 30 in that range. That's certainly usable on 2 meters because that's what I'm talking on right now. It goes up to about maybe minus 10, give or take, as I go higher in frequency. At 250, it goes to like minus 25, minus 30 almost again, approaching 440, 450, you see another dip, and then it goes and sort of flattens out and becomes, you know, usable up to 800, 900 megahertz. How does this antenna do that when all the element lengths are the same, like the radials, which are 45 degrees down, they're all the same length, and the horizontal antenna, part of the antenna,